Okay, so the next panel will consider the challenge and complexities of democratization in the Muslim world, and I'm particularly pleased to chair this panel with three excellent presenters. We have Judy Barcelo, Vice President and Director of our grant program, who will speak about Islamists between radicalization and moderation. Mona Yacobian, Special Advisor to the Muslim World Initiative, who will give a talk about how to engage with the Islamists. And Dan Bramberg, Special Advisor to the Muslim World Initiative, who will talk about how to build effective democratic oppositions in the Arab world. I will ask each speaker to speak for about 10-15 minutes and to come to the podium, please.
Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for inviting me to be on this panel. I view my presentation as a sort of theme setter for this panel, identifying some broad issues and raising some important questions, some of which I believe my esteemed colleagues on the panel will delve into more deeply. My presentation focuses on four main points and draws most immediately on experiences from the Middle East, although I believe that many of these points pertain to the broader Muslim world. In summary, the four main points are the following. Number one, one size does not fit all. Islamists range widely in their religious and political beliefs. Number two, interest by Islamists in open participation in legal political arenas is high, and their participation is widespread. Number three, the jury is still out on whether or not political participation by Islamists and their interaction with secular political forces moderates their politics and influences their core values and beliefs. And finally, number four, outsiders beware. Efforts by outsiders to influence internal domestic political systems and processes in Muslim-majority countries present very major challenges and may backfire. So let me go back over these points. The first, again, is one size does not fit all. Islamists range widely in their religious and political philosophies and goals. Now, how do most experts define Islamist? Essentially, an Islamist is anyone who believes that the Quran and the Hadith, traditions of the Prophet's life, actions, and words, contain important principles about Muslim governance and society. And Islamists believe in trying to actually implement these principles in the real world. So understood in that definition, Islamists range from terrorists, such as Osama bin Laden and his colleagues in Al-Qaeda, to the moderate Wasat parties in Jordan and Egypt, to the ruling Justice and Development Party in Turkey that seeks Turkish membership in the EU and heads a government that has relations with the State of Israel. If one understands that the term Islamist covers this vast range of political beliefs, it becomes clear that the struggle is not only between Islamist political forces and secular forces, but perhaps more fundamentally within the Islamist realm between moderate and extremist streams within the camp of the Islamists. Number two, my second major point is that interest by Islamists in open participation in legal political arenas and political life is high, and their participation is widespread. Now, why is this? Why do Islamists want to participate in political life? Well, first of all, and most fundamentally, Islamist political thought emphasizes the importance of just governance. Without disputing that Islamist definitions of justice and just governance vary widely, it is also without dispute that many Muslims around the world live in societies that are governed by authoritarian or semi-authoritarian governments in which there is little justice to be had. Moreover, Islamists, even the moderate ones, are special targets of repression by undemocratic regimes, subject to imprisonment, torture, and even death in many states in the Arab world and beyond. In Egypt, for example, many, if not most, of the tens of the thousands of political prisoners are Islamists. For this reason, moderate Islamists tend to see participation in legal electoral processes as a way out from repression. As primary victims of authoritarian rule, they view themselves as potential major beneficiaries of regime change leading to democratic governance. Islamists are also attracted to participation in the electoral arena because they have a major advantage. They tend to be far better organized than their secular counterparts because they have far superior organizational support systems through their mosques and other religious institutions. in electoral systems designed by authoritarian or semi-authoritarian regimes that are designed to limit the participation of all opposition, it's the secular parties that are hit hardest by this. Secular parties, unlike Islamist parties, don't have social and religious networks that are based on religious institutions that provide social welfare benefits. And many of these social institutions operate outside the political sphere. So while the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt can provide support by giving tutoring programs for school children, providing earthquake relief, providing aid to the poor, and they gain popularity and name recognition through these outreach efforts, the secular parties, by contrast, are left behind in the dust. Now, my third major point is the jury is still out on whether or not political participation by Islamists moderates their politics and, most importantly, their core values and beliefs. There's a growing literature focused on the behavior of Islamist political parties and movements. USIP alone has 14 active grants that are still underway by researchers around the world who are studying the goals, the strategies, the behavior and operations of Islamist political parties and movements around the world. Among the questions that these grantees and other scholars who are studying these issues are asking are the following. First of all, how does the construction of electoral systems shape the behavior of Islamist parties and the secular parties against which they compete for power? Secondly, are Islamist parties cooperating or coordinating with secular parties to compete more effectively at the polls, especially in systems where the regime is intent on squeezing out all opposition? And if so, what form does that cooperation take? Thirdly, when secular and Islamist parties cooperate or collaborate in joint efforts, for example, to lobby governing regimes to broaden the political space within which they can compete for power, or even to work together on specific issues, is there any evidence that this interaction changes the way that Islamist parties think about their politics and their core values? For example, are Islamist parties who have collaborated with secular parties more likely to soften their positions on the question of the right of women to divorce or how to handle perpetrators of honor crimes? And then finally, are Islamists embracing electoral politics for purely pragmatic reasons because they know that doing so will help them bring them to power? What happens when Islamists gain political power? Does their commitment to democracy and human rights end at that point? And are they prepared to give up power if they lose popular support? These are among the most important questions that the scholars are now focusing on. The answers to these questions are incomplete, not only because there's lots of research still underway, but also because circumstances in various Muslim-majority countries around the world are evolving in significant ways. But again, one size does not fit all. Answers vary from one country to the next. In Turkey, for example, which has a well-established democratic culture in which both secular and Islamist parties have successfully competed for power, and in which an Islamist party, the JDP, currently holds power, it's hard to imagine that an election defeat at the polls by the JDP would result in their refusing to relinquish power. By contrast, the situation is clearly different in Iran and Sudan, for example, where Islamists have gained power but have worked very hard to prevent anyone else from taking over and will try to do anything they can to retain power at all costs. While the jury is still out on some countries, there's good evidence, however, that more conservative Islamist parties in places like Egypt, Jordan, and Kuwait embrace procedural aspects of democracy while rejecting the liberal values that go with democracy. So the answer to the question of whether Islamist parties practice or embrace democracy depends in part on how one defines democracy. If one goes beyond a minimalist definition, namely the competition for political power through regular elections, and extends the definition to include an appreciation for the protection of basic civil liberties and human rights, it seems that many of the more conservative Islamist parties in the Arab world have not fully embraced the full range of democratic values. Given these concerns, a central challenge is figuring out ways to construct political systems in which secular and Islamist parties compete on a level playing field, remembering my earlier point that the secular parties are a major disadvantage because they don't have the name recognition or the social networks through the religious institutions. My final point is outsiders beware. efforts to influence internal domestic political systems and processes in Muslim-majority countries may present major definitely present major challenges and may backfire. At a fundamental level, there are two basic alternatives. One is to encourage or permit moderate Islamists to participate legally and nonviolently within political systems and to compete for political power in the hope that Islamists will not be driven underground and will embrace militancy as a political strategy. The other alternative is to exclude them from participation. Now, we've seen what happened in the Palestinian territories when Hamas unexpectedly came to power through an election in which an electorate that was clearly fed up with the corruption and mismanagement of Fatah basically threw the guys out of office. Yet now that they've won a seat at the table, fair and square, the United States and the European Union and others refused to deal with them until they renounced terrorism and recognized Israel. While there are also a lot of other forces at work, clearly the current political impasse is causing the Palestinian territories at this point to enter a sort of downward spiral towards civil war. And this impasse between Islamists and non-Islamists is at the core of this. So what does the alternative look like? What happens when Islamists are largely locked out of the political system? For that, we can look to Egypt, which for many years marginalized and weakened not only Islamist parties, but of course all opposition parties, both secular and religious in nature. Confronted with a very serious problem of Islamist militancy, Egypt's policy of imprisoning and torturing Islamists arguably not only helped radicalize Islamist movements that emerged in the 1980s, such as al-Jihad al-Islami, it also helped export terrorism when Islamists found it too hard to stay at home, too hot to stay at home, and the options for political participation too limited. The situation, of course, has eased up somewhat now, with Islamists running for political office quite successfully in the last election, but not under the banner of the Muslim Brotherhood. So, to sum up, this means we have a real challenge on our hands. Bearing in mind that the construction of the political rules of the road is the prerogative of national governments, not the international system or other international players, what strategies can outside actors develop to encourage national governments to devise policies that do the following? Number one, promote the emergence of democracy in Muslim-majority countries while bottling up Islamic militancy, because it's a double challenge. At the same time, it has to be dealt with simultaneously. Number two, creating conditions in which secular parties can compete successfully with extremely popular Islamist parties. And number three, creating rules of the road that prevent Islamists from transforming democratic systems or democratizing systems if and when they achieve power. Fundamentally, what is at stake is the development of policies by national and international actors that encourage Muslim citizens inclined otherwise to embrace extremism to instead support moderation. Clearly, there's no way, however, and this is, you know, my sort of final thought, there's no way to really talk about democratic reform in the Arab world or other parts of the Muslim world if some of the most popular political movements, which by definition are Islamist, are excluded from participation from the system. So, as they say, the devil is in the details, and I think it's the details that my colleagues will be getting into. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Judy, for the sovereign assessment. Mona?
Good morning, and thank you, Judy, for setting my presentation up so well, because I think Judy has laid out a number of the big questions that we are all endeavoring to try and answer. I have recently completed a study of U.S.-funded efforts to engage moderate Islamist parties in the region in four specific cases: Morocco, Algeria, Jordan, and Yemen. And I looked specifically at the efforts of the National Democratic Institute, NDI, and its Republican counterpart, the International Republican Institute, IRI, since 2001, really using 9/11 as kind of a watershed event since that time in those four countries. Now, first, why those four? These country cases, I would say, with the possible exception of Algeria, demonstrate relative political openness. And as well, their Islamist opposition movements have a noted degree of strength and vibrancy. In each of these countries, Islamist opposition parties play a key role in domestic politics. They have fared quite well in elections. Typically, they are the most powerful opposition force in the country. And furthermore, they've played a key role in pushing and militating for greater political opening and change in each of those countries. Now, the study considered several key questions, but the most important was focused on trying to understand how Islamist parties have responded over time to U.S. efforts to engage them in democratic promotion activities. Specifically, I was trying to look at, essentially, have in effect U.S. efforts to engage Islamist parties in democracy promotion help to moderate their agendas, their politics, and so forth. As Judy noted, there are trends within parties that range from more moderate to more hardline. Have these efforts helped, have U.S. efforts helped to reinforce moderates within parties? Now, she also laid out, and I want to underscore, the difficulties inherent in trying to answer these questions. First of all, how does one document evolution toward greater moderation? I would say it's difficult, if not impossible, to quantify or you know, empirically measure such shifts. Nonetheless, the implementers themselves, whom I interviewed and talked to, suggested a number of key indicators that might help to gauge whether or not parties are shifting their worldview, shifting their position toward greater moderation. These include reviewing, doing a sort of content analysis, if you will, of party platforms, leadership statements and other public documents, gauging the degree of internal transparency evident within a party, internal democracy, examining a party's role in parliament, or if they have positions at local councils, within the local councils, what kinds of policies do they promote, what kinds of positions do they take. And finally, also assessing the willingness of parties to cooperate with secular counterparts, particularly on the issue of promoting political reform. Nonetheless, and again, I think Judy underscored well the difficulties in this, it is quite difficult to come to some kind of hard and fast conclusion. And in particular, I would underscore two particular difficulties. One is, are shifts that we may be witnessing within Islamist parties purely pragmatic politics, or do they suggest a deeper normative shift in their worldview? And the second is, if in fact we could say that there were normative shifts occurring, to what extent have U.S. democracy promotion efforts and efforts to engage these parties played a role? I think it's very, very difficult to ascertain direct linkages, although, again, and if we have more time, we can talk a bit about some of those. So what were my conclusions? I'm going to skip right to them, given the time. Essentially, of the four cases that I looked at, I found Morocco to hold the greatest promise with respect to U.S. engagement of moderate Islamists. Of the two principal implementers that I looked at, NDI in particular had cultivated a strong working relationship with the Party for Justice and Development since that party's founding in 1997. For its part, the PJD has demonstrated a strong degree of moderation. It's evident in its platform, in its highly evolved position on Sharia law, for example, in its insistence on working within Morocco's monarchical system, on the high degree of internal transparency that's evident within the party. And finally, it has also shown a willingness to cooperate with secular parties on areas of reform, although I think in the Moroccan case, this is actually less so than in some of the other cases I looked at. Indeed, I would say the PJD's experiences may well represent the Arab world's most important test case for the question of inclusion of moderate Islamists in the political system. The party has played a key role in Morocco's nascent political opening and is expected to fare quite well in next year's parliamentary elections. It may result, in fact, in the PJD being the senior partner in a new coalition government. So it's certainly a situation that bears watching. While Morocco stands out as perhaps the most promising example of U.S. engagement, each of the other cases that I investigated also found some important, if limited, instances of success. In Yemen, for example, NDI's role of fostering a unique Islamist secular alliance known as the Joint Meeting Parties, or the JMP, is laudable. I don't think I've witnessed, frankly, that type of secular Islamist cooperation over a period of time and devoted particularly to the issue of pushing reform. And in particular, I think analysts and those who watch and are looking for trends of democratic change in the Arab world point to the necessity of these types of coalitions in order to gain the kind of momentum necessary to force recalcitrant regimes to change and to open up. So I think in this sense, Yemen offers important insights that could be and should be emulated elsewhere in the region. In Jordan, the impact of U.S. engagement, I think, is far less notable. And here, I think, a clear disadvantage is the unwillingness of the Islamic Action Front, the IAF, a Muslim Brotherhood affiliate, to work directly or closely with U.S. organizations. The party has an implicit boycott of U.S. organizations in protest over U.S. policy in the region. So as such, democracy promotion implementers were working primarily with the Wasat Party, a much smaller, newer Islamist party. It is, as its name suggests, a centrist party. Wasat in Arabic means center or center. And I think in this sense, it's important because this may well be a trend throughout the region. There is as well a Wasat Party in Egypt. And it is this centrist Islamist trend that may bear watching. And in that sense, I think the initial work that's been done in Jordan is important and may sow the seeds for broader efforts. Let me now conclude, I think, with three broader conclusions. First, across the board, U.S. efforts to engage moderate Islamists resulted in a strong working relationships being developed that were also characterized by a high degree of professionalism. Regular contact between democracy promoters and Islamist party partners was a feature. Sometimes meetings took place as frequently as biweekly. As well, Islamist parties, as Judy noted, have demonstrated great enthusiasm and interest in participating in programs and workshops. A strong reservoir of trust was also built up. However, in nearly every case, anger over U.S. policies, particularly in Iraq and Palestine, intervened, leading to boycotts, and suspicions over U.S. intentions still remain quite high. Nonetheless, even during those boycotts, often informal dialogue and contact was continued. I think this element of diplomacy, if you will, constitutes an ancillary but nonetheless very important benefit of this kind of engagement. Secondly, I think there are actually two sort of deeper philosophical conclusions I think bear mention. First, given the strategic importance assigned to the promotion of democracy in the Arab world, it is essential to consider the role of moderate Islamist parties. These parties have proven time and again their popular strength, their ability to win free elections. They have also, I think, shown a capacity to evolve toward greater moderation. And while this evolution bears and deserves close scrutiny, I think fears of Islamist parties running amok and Iranian-style theocracies sprouting throughout the Arab world are exaggerated. Powerful arguments exist for the inclusion of these moderate parties in the region's fragile political openings, and it therefore follows that U.S. democracy promotion should as well entail engaging these critical actors. Finally, U.S. engagement of moderate Islamists must be understood within a broader political context. And here I would reference the earlier panel that some of you may have listened to on the question of Islamist militancy in the region. The Arab world, indeed the Muslim world, is in the throes of an ideological battle to define the role of Islam in public life. The threat of Islamist extremism has pervaded each of the four countries that I looked at to varying degrees. In all, however, I would say that moderate Islamist parties who reject violence and practice democratic ideals serve as a critical counterweight to these forces. These parties could play a critical role in developing an indigenous, forward-looking counter-ideology to help bring the Arab world into the 21st century, albeit on its own terms. Engaging these forces, therefore, is essential to understanding and influencing this broader ideological struggle. And I will
Great. Thank you very much, Mona. Interesting finding. Dan?
Well, good morning, and soon to be good afternoon to everybody. Thanks very much for having me at this panel. Abdul Salam, I really want to thank you for your leadership of the Muslim World Initiative, and it's really been an interesting experience working here part-time at USIP. I was delighted that the two previous speakers somewhat stole my thunder, because I was up a good part of the night with my two-and-a-half-year-old. I don't have much thunder left to offer you this morning. And but seriously, they said a lot that I really wanted to say, so I want to sort of be as economical as I possibly can and focus on some of the issues. Mona's paper is really ahead of the curve. There's been a lot of work and papers from various think tanks in the last few months advocating working with Islamist parties, but of course this has been going on for a long time. The U.S. is actively engaged in working with Islamist parties all over the region, legitimate Islamist parties. And it's high time that we had an evaluation of that experience. We are, I might add, going to organize a separate panel to look at in more depth at Mona's paper and invite activists from NDI and IRI to come and comment as well. So that will be forthcoming. I also wish to emphasize that the project that Mona is part of is one that I've helped organize with a major financial support from the United States Agency for International Development. USAID had provided us with support to look in depth at the whole question of political relations between Islamist and non-Islamist parties. And by that, I use the term non-Islamist quite deliberately, because not all non-Islamist parties are secular parties. So AID provided us a grant to look at that, and they also provided a separate, smaller grant to do Mona's project. And the studies of efforts to build political alliances between Islamists and non-Islamists in Morocco and Yemen and in Jordan and Egypt, those are coming into USIP as we speak, and we are looking forward on November 10th to a half-day seminar/conference looking in depth at these four-country case studies, and their authors will be here as well as several commentators. So we will invite you to that within a week or so. So you should look forward to that. I want to say, by way of framing this whole question of the effectiveness or lack there of Arab political oppositions, that the first thing to keep in mind about the region we're dealing with is that in some sense, political reform is not a new agenda item. It's not as if suddenly, as a consequence of 9/11 or the impetus of the American government or some shock to the region, indigenous or exogenous, suddenly reform was undertaken. The reform game has been played for a long time in the region. It was initiated, in many respects, elaborated by the late Anwar Sadat, and the political reform game has always involved opening up a certain degree of political space for opposition groups to participate in a set of arrangements, including electoral arrangements, that have been designed to allow for participation without threatening the hegemony of the ruling elite. And this ruling elite rules through a process of formal political institutions, but also through a process of informal politics, and we also have a separate project on that at USIP. And I think this issue of informal politics remains, in many respects, perhaps the most significant obstacle to moving the reform process forward. So this combination of formal and informal rules and institutions created a certain degree of space for political participation, but was designed to make sure that that space could not be exploited to basically undermine the political hegemony of these ruling elites. And we saw that game played with fairly exceptional skill in Egypt, and we saw it in Morocco for many years. We've seen it in Yemen. We have seen it in Kuwait, Jordan. We've seen Bahrain sort of adopting the liberalized autocracy model of one kind or the other. And that model has really been one in which that's not only, and this is the point I want to emphasize here, that model has not only benefited regimes, which can get a certain degree of legitimacy without surrendering power. It's the genius of the system. That model has benefited political oppositions. And this may sound counterintuitive, but in fact it's been the case. The chief beneficiaries of semi-autocracy in the Arab world have been Islamist parties. Islamist parties because they are well organized, because while they do not represent, in terms of public opinion, this is my own sense of reading the literature, a absolute majority, they are an extremely well organized plurality. While there are secular opposition parties, do not have the same high level of organization. The liberalized autocracies of the Arab world have opened up political space for Islamists to engage in dialogues, power sharing in some cases, and to extract from their own patrons in these regimes, and we see this very clearly in Kuwait and in Jordan and Egypt, certain kinds of concessions, particularly on cultural and religious issues, that speak to their agendas. And so this has been a kind of game that has benefited Islamist oppositions considerably. Now, it's also benefited non-Islamist groups as well, because many non-Islamist groups have looked for many years at the status quo and looked at these semi-authoritarian regimes, and while they're very unhappy with them, have seen these regimes as the only bulwark between them and an Islamist victory. And the consequence of that is you've had this phenomenon in the Arab world, which I've referred to as autocracy with potential democrats, the persistence of autocracy, but with key groups basically saying, well, I'm not going to mobilize, I'm not going to contest because, well, basically these guys, this military regime, you know, they're the ones, and it's not simply Algeria that is sort of the test case of this. You see this sort of logic wherever you go throughout the region. So for different and very particularistic reasons, you've had a kind of working consensus that this system is better than full autocracy, the kind of Saddam Hussein Iraq model on the one hand, or full democratization. The full autocracy is too bloody and excludes. Full democratization is a black hole that may lead to the empowerment of our Islamist competitors. We'll complain about it because secular political leaders are constantly complaining, or non-Islamist leaders are constantly complaining that this is not a game that they accept. But in effect, the behavior is what counts. And they look to these semi-autocratic regimes as their umbrella from the black hole of a full competitive election that could allow for the victory of Islamists. Now, over the past few years, and I'm glad that Yemen and Morocco is mentioned because I think they're both examples of this, the kind of tacit consensus from Islamist and non-Islamist parties over accepting or acquiescing and sometimes abetting the status quo has begun to fray. Islamists look at the status quo and they say, well, we've collaborated in effect with a lot of these regimes, but we've only gotten so far. And these regimes are still corrupt, they still pursue policies on a domestic and foreign level that we don't agree with, and we would like to have something more than a kind of state-managed game of political liberalization. And then secular parties and groups, they're not really parties, I'll get to that in a moment, secular groups or non-Islamist groups, to be more specific, look at the status quo and they say, well, we get protection from these regimes, but we don't get anything else. Right? We don't get anything else because the Islamists have the mosques and even in the universities. I mean, I was a student at Cairo University. If you shut down, if you don't have real competitive elections but people are allowed to pray religiously and organize religiously on campus, you know who's going to win a truly open and competitive electoral game in the student council elections. So the non-Islamist parties look at this and say, well, you know, this system is benefiting our competitors, and the consequence of that is the fact that the only groups that really win elections in the make significant inroads in semi-open competitive elections are Islamists. Every time that happens, it increases the perception of ruling regimes that full democratization is unacceptable because it's too dangerous and too risky. And so we go through this cycle of opening and closing that you see over and over again. And we may or may not see this in Morocco. We don't know yet. Hopefully the cycle will not be repeated and we'll see a continuing opening, but it's far from clear. And so secular parties look at that and say, well, we have to somehow break this cycle, this trap. We have to find some way out of it. And so you've had, interestingly enough, these interesting efforts in Yemen in particular, to some extent in Jordan, and in Morocco with a different flavor, at trying to build coalitions. And those coalitions are potentially very significant, because if you could have effective and durable coalitions between Islamist and non-Islamist parties that increase the political leverage of oppositions, if in fact there were genuine reform-minded elites within regimes, you could have this possible coalition that the transitions literature talks all about. So the absolute requirement for real democratization, in the absence of the collapse of the regime, the only way you'll get democratization is a negotiated outcome. And so you've got to increase the political leverage of these oppositions. And if it's just Islamists and nobody else containing Islamists, even the moderate Islamist parties, if they're the only ones that are speaking, you'll never get the leverage, because soft-line moderates within regimes will look and say, well, I mean, we can't propose democratization because we'll be swept out of power by the Islamist opposition. So to reinforce the authority and leverage of reformists within regimes, you need these coalitions. You need these coalitions, because the issue is not simply, and here's a point I wish to make that may differ a little bit from my colleagues, the issue here is not merely the question of whether Islamist parties are using violence or not, so-called moderate or extremist parties. The issue here is the cultural and religious agenda of even the moderate Islamist parties. Now, I'm a Democrat, this is a personal opinion here, and if the next 10 years you look at the red and blue map of the United States, and as a consequence of Democratic elections, my kind of secular vision of politics is excluded from politics as a consequence of democracy, I'm not going to be a Democrat very long. And the problem with Islamist parties, even the moderates, you find this in PJD and Morocco too, because the leadership speaks this language of democracy, reforming Sharia, but the base is dubious of that language, many of them. So unless there's a basic strategic commitment to real democracy, not for simply tactical purposes, and unless this sort of cultural agenda of Islamization, even from the moderate parties, is moderated and attenuated, you won't get these coalitions, and you will not get coalitions within oppositions, and you won't get coalitions between regimes and oppositions, and therefore you won't get a movement out of the cycle of sort of limited reforms opening and closing. We've seen in some cases now for 2+ decades, depending on the country you're talking about. And therefore, this leads me to the following set of conclusions, or certainly recommendations with some sort of policy element to them. And first of all, and speaking almost parenthetically, it's been said this morning, my own personal feeling is that you can't talk about major significant political reform in the Middle East without a resolution of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. I mean, I just say that, so I put that out there. I mean, I just think it's the gorilla in the room, it's out there, and to talk about sort of all these possibilities with this thing just sitting there and never resolved, it sucks up all the air. It really does, and it's doing so on a global level now, because communications have allowed the Palestinian conflict to come into the TV rooms, the living rooms of Indonesians sitting in Jakarta 24 hours a day. I mean, it's unprecedented. So that's something that I think is a basic requirement. But beyond that, a few observations. First of all, it's important to work with Islamist parties, but it's also important to work with non-Islamist parties. And this has been said before, but I think it's the hard nut to crack here. Find ways to give them political expression beyond civil society. And I want to make a point of this. When you go to Morocco and you talk to the non-Islamist groups and leaders, the professionals, the NGO people, and you say, will you join a political party? They laugh in your face. They don't want to have anything to do with political parties, because political parties are corrupt, blah, 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 blah. And NGOs and civil society cannot substitute for effective political parties. You need to create, and we need to work with and enhance the negotiating power of non-Islamist groups, which would mean, in part, and this is the big catch-22, it's a horse and cart problem, obviously, basically convincing political elites, and these ruling elites, to create this, to allow the space for these parties to develop. But moreover, looking for fissures within these ruling parties, real fissures, not the kind of fake fissures we see in Egypt, but real fissures within ruling parties, such that you can get a breakaway party and find opportunities for competition from new parties that may have been affiliated with the ruling parties, but really set out on their own. So you have to sort of look at party development as a key factor from above and from below. The other factor there are two factors I'll mention, and we can go on to this in more detail in our quick discussion, is the capacity to create these sort of dynamics is, for better or for worse, maybe for worse, in part determined by the nature of the political regimes themselves. And it's not a coincidence that, in many respects, the most pluralization we have seen and the most forward movement away from the legacy of liberal isotocracy so far has been in Morocco, because Morocco is a monarchy in which the monarch basically arbitrates between different political groups and is able to do so in a way that has been very effective limiting the political reform. But when a new monarch came in and basically stood back and said, okay, we can move forward, the arbitrating power of the monarch was central to allowing this process to go forward. You don't have the same opportunities in what might be called the presidential monarchies of Egypt or of Yemen, because these monarchs are captured by strong political machines and are not really, these presidential monarchs are not really allowed to stray far off the reservation. So in part, some of our best opportunities may be precisely in countries where monarchs play this arbitrating role. It's not true of all, by the way, monarchies. Some monarchies don't really have that kind of sway, but they do in several key cases, and it's not a coincidence that the Moroccan case is an important example of that. I think it's also very important to engage new constituencies in backing and supporting the emergence of effective political parties. One of the things that I found encouraging in Morocco was the existence of business groups willing to support the creation of new political parties and not just NGOs. In effect, and I'll conclude here, we have to look at ways of creating a more level political playing field. Judy said this at the outset, that creates real competition, because I believe, while I certainly share Abdel-Salam's commitment to this notion, I really think it's an important part of the USIP mission, of promoting a kind of liberal Islamic pluralistic sort of alternative, I also think that the concrete constraints and incentives of real competition in the long run will play a crucial role in making it clear even to the so-called moderate parties the limits of their capacity to impose their agenda. And to the extent that those limits are there, you will have other dynamics intervening and we'll have a process that moves us forward. If they're not, I don't remain very optimistic for the possibilities of further political reform. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Dan, and thanks to all the panelists. You have given us a lot of big issues to discuss. I will just go directly to the audience. I know many of you would like to ask questions or make comments, and if you could just please identify yourselves and ask questions.
Yes. Robert Friedman, Baltimore Hebrew University and Johns Hopkins University, both to Abdel-Salam and also to Mona. I'd like to discuss the Jordanian case a bit. It wasn't mentioned for some reason in the first panel, but King Abdullah II seems to be taking the lead among those trying to create a, quote, moderate Islamic consensus throughout the Muslim world, not just the Arab world, convening conferences, trying to arrange understandings among Muslims that you can't delegitimize other Muslims, this type of thing. You had one last summer. Now, my question to you is this genuine, or is this tactical as a means of, A, outflanking the Islamic Action Front, which to a certain extent shot itself in the foot over the summer by hailing Zarqawi as a martyr? And secondly, if in fact the Islamic Action Front has become somewhat delegitimized, does that give a little bit more room for the centrist Islamic Party?
Let me just address the idea of empowering moderate Islam. Clearly, I think the project, in order to be successful, effective, to have impact, it will have to be done by legitimate representative actors, including diverse views within Islam, not just official Islam. And my sense is that any attempt by governments or states or rulers to take on that project, it will dismiss it immediately.
I think what King Abdullah has done is quite interesting, and it does speak to this broader ideological battle that I touched on and that was addressed, I think, more thoroughly in the previous panel. I think it's essential to view those kinds of moves within the political context in which they occur. In the case of Jordan, the hotel bombings in Amman, which were a tragic event resulting in the loss of many, as you know, Muslim civilian, innocent civilian lives. That event, I think, very much put the IAF on the defensive. And I think that King Abdullah is using that event to talk about the need to battle extremist Islam, and Islam that many will say is in fact a perversion of the religion and that does not represent the religion.
By the way, I think a similar dynamic was at play in Morocco with the bombings in Casablanca. Same kind of thing took place. The PJD has, I think, responded much more intelligently to that. Whether or not that can actually make a difference is another question entirely, because while the king may be holding these conferences and so forth with regard to Jordan's internal political dynamics, I think the system is still very, very closed. Political parties, with the exception of the IAF, are virtually non-existent. One described them to me as essentially Amman-based salons, and that includes probably the Wasat Party. And so can the Wasat Party gain traction is a huge question, but again, it has to be done within an environment that enables that traction to take place, and I don't see it yet in Jordan.
Just a quick remark on that. I think that and it's been said before, and our colleague this morning said on the previous panel, you start building up an alternative to radical Islam from the primary grades on up, right, from first grade or before. Most young people in the Arab world get schooled through public schools, not through independent madrasas. A readiness and willingness of governments, it's a very simple thing, to teach and promote democracy and pluralism from the first grade up, would make a tremendous difference. But there's a real hesitation still to do so in many of the countries because, for obvious reasons. The ruling parties fear the consequences of promoting that sort of ideology. So there's a tremendous amount to be done in the field of education if these governments are serious about providing an alternative to Islamist extremism.
Yeah, in terms of this issue of the kind of extremism of one party creating political space for another, a more moderate Islamist party, I think is an interesting one. And, of course, the central problem is that often these parties really don't get tested in the real world. They're not allowed to come to power. Voters aren't really given the opportunity to measure them up against alternatives. And so that's one of the critical, you know, issues here. Clearly, if you go, you know, to Egypt after a bombing or Jordan, you know, on a popular level, there's mass repudiation of militant tactics, you know, and terrorist bombings. And you would think that this would drive people into the arms of the more moderate parties. Until you can actually test them at the polls, let them govern for a period of time, you know, it's hard for voters to make those assessments about exactly where those parties stand. One of the grant projects that we're about to start funding is asking women their views on Hamas and Hezbollah. I mean, women involved in liberation struggles and supporting Islamist parties arguably at some level are leaving behind other goals that they could attain in terms of achieving equal rights within their social and religious and political systems. And so what is it that compels women to make those decisions? And I mean, I think you need to test these questions in different, each setting is a little bit different from the next, but this problem of not being able to test the parties and hold them accountable for their positions through an electoral process is at the core of the problem here.
Great, sir.
Colonel Dutta, Foreign Policy Association. At the outset, I would like to apologize for this maybe certain impairment of speech because of recent illness, but the discussions today, especially on the radicalism and moderation, take me back to my days in service when I was commandant of interrogation cell of all the infiltrators coming to Kashmir. And ironically, we have the infiltrators with an age of 13 years to 22 years at the most, touching 30, but from the countries like which have been now dubbed as moderate Islamic countries, Morocco, Algeria, Yemen, Jordan, and of course Saudi Arabia. And incidentally, Zarqawi was from Jordan and educated and really got indoctrinated Mr. Osama bin Laden himself. But my observations and consulting the notes this morning were that a jihadist who would maybe one of those children recruited from those political parties' leaders. Their children were jihadists who were recruited, sent across the border under the pan-Islamic, campaign. He is recruited at an impressionable age, brainwashed with inadequate interpretation of Quran, that teaches him that anybody who is not a believer in Islam, a non-believer, should be killed, liquidated. I term it as inadequate. And since why they should be killed now, that they should be, as a matter of fact, they are the culprit for really opposing the spreading tide of Islam, and they should not be allowed to live.
Sir, could you please ask a question?
Yeah, could you? We're hoping we only have 6 minutes left. We have other people.
Yeah,
we're hoping
sorry.
For a question. We're just searching for the question.
Question.
Okay, I'm just trying to make it as brief as possible. This I apologize. Now, it is a sacred duty to give your life for Islam and to them, and a word like democracy is abhorrent. Now, they have been brought up on this brainwashing. What are these reformist parties whom you cited just now in these countries are doing something about it?
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Question.
Thank you.
I think what the gentleman has framed essentially this battle that we've described before. Again, I view these moderate reformist parties as being a very important counterweight to precisely the type of extremist activity which I think represents very much a fringe of the religion that you've described.
Well, let me just add one word. I think that realistically the best hope, the greatest potential for meaningful democratic change in the Muslim world will have to involve or include these moderate reformist parties. The secular alternative, liberal democracy, are simply not on the agenda. So it is important, I think, to draw on Islamic progressive modernist traditions to legitimate and to advance the badly needed reforms in the Muslim world.
Good afternoon. I'm Edward Villacrest. I work at the Director for Strategic Plans and Policy at the Pentagon. And I wanted to bring up the issue of hate speech. And it's an issue that when we deal with things like racism and Nazism, it's really a big part of countering radicalization. And if you look at some of the media, both print, video, and even discourse and speeches coming out of the Islamist parties, the hate speech in them is actually often shocking and really stunning even. And when we work with these Islamist parties, which I'm one of the people in the Pentagon who advocates that this is something that we absolutely have to do, is this something we need to do, is to challenge the hate speech, and just like we did in dealing with racism and things like that, that is a big part of the issue?
Well, I'll say I have written a little bit about this kind of parenthetically in some of my work. I think it's a huge issue, because even if you look at moderate political Islamist parties. PJD, for example, in its publication Tajdeed, they always say this is pluralism, you know, so I suppose if we had the Washington Post inviting the Klan in, this would be an example of pluralism. But they say we have to give a voice to these because they're part of the competition and part of the discussion. But you, as a consequence, you see a level often. Even the mainstream press in Kuwait is extraordinary. What is, in some respects, base anti-Semitic language is extraordinary. And this has become diffused throughout the region, and even on a more, I've seen it up close in Indonesia. I don't know what the answer, by the way, is to it. I think we have to recognize the problem, and a lot of people do not, people feel very uncomfortable with the problem you've just articulated. I know this from experience. In part because it's so diffuse and it's so hard to know what to deal with it. My own quick answer is that in part we have to sort of, in the region of the Arab world, change the dynamics that creates and feeds this sort of ideology. Because it really reflects a huge level of fundamental unhappiness with a whole set of issues, including American foreign policy. But the first thing to do is to recognize that this is diffuse, and it exists in mainstream opposition presses of the Islamic world, and we have to be upfront with our interlocutors. I would hope that when NDI's people and IRA go out there and they say, hey, look at this front page article. What is this? Are you serving your own interests by allowing this sort of hate speech to exist? And to make it clear to the leaders of these parties who are moderates, I mean, the leader of PGD, there's no question about that, he's a moderate in the genuine strategic sense. Does he benefit from essentially turning a blind eye to some of this language? I'd say no.
Could I just jump in on this? I think it's an excellent question, and in fact, it certainly has come up in the work that I did, and in fact, exactly what Dan described, the question of calling parties to task through this engagement for saying one thing in one place and saying something else in another is an essential feature of those meetings, and that has taken place. Nonetheless, I also would endorse what Dan said, that this is a deeper ideological phenomenon. It's not only limited to the opposition press. You see it in the official press. Al-Ahram newspaper in Egypt is one of the worst violators. So I think we have to be careful that we don't analytically ascribe this kind of hate speech, which you rightly, I think, find abhorrent, as do all of us, simply to the Islamists. It's a phenomenon that pervades the region, and I think it speaks to a much deeper fundamental issue with regard to anti-Americanism and the anti-Semitism that's still prevalent there.
Let me just add that, you know, this is, as I tried to suggest in my comments, not a simple problem of reform. You can't fix one part of the problem without addressing other parts of the problem. If you're only defining democracy as regular elections and nothing beyond that, you have, you know, you're really coming at this blind. Clearly, in many of these countries, responsible journalism is not a normal practice. And it's not a normal practice, as Mona suggested, either by opposition groups or by regime, you know, mouthpieces. And part of democracy, as we understand it here, I think is the operation of a free press, which is held accountable for the statements that are articulated through it, and so, or that it promotes through op-eds or what have you. So you can't just focus on fixing one little part of this problem. You've got to focus on the broader issue of political reform as it includes, you know, free speech and and the operation of a free press.
Okay, the last question, please, sir.
My name is Ahmed Solomon, business consultant, and my question is the following. Besides promoting democracy and using it as a tool to moderate Islamist parties, don't you think that also we should tackle the breeding ground for extremism, which is, in my opinion, unemployment, poverty, and illiteracy, and especially religious illiteracy? Because in certain countries, they found to their advantage that at a certain time, secular schools had moderate religion taught to its students. And the regimes there, thinking that it would be counterproductive to them, started lessening the amount of, or even taking it off the whole thing. So don't you think that besides democracy, we should also tackle these other aspects?
Yeah, well, I think that the equation of democratization or reform simply with the organization of election is very simplistic and reductive, and in my sense would not lead to any result. I think we should pay closer attention to the issues of transparency, the rule of law, human rights issues, gender equality. These are what we consider the normative issues of democratization. There is a whole range of social and economic problems that are important. However, I do not take it for granted that poverty necessarily lead to extremism everywhere. I mean, from sociological profiles of extremists or various groups, we just don't have that. That doesn't stand up to that. I mean, we do have different terrorists from different backgrounds. This doesn't mean that we should neglect social and economic reforms. On the contrary, there are institutions that have been working for years on this, the World Bank, and with still a lot of work to be done, obviously. So this panel is really more on the democratization and institutional issues, but we should keep in mind the social problems as well.
It's a terribly interesting question that we'd have a whole day to spend on such a question, wouldn't
yeah.
we? Because it's been a fundamental part of the debates, particularly since 9/11. But if you take Morocco, for example, I think Morocco illustrates some of the problems we're talking about here. You've had a series of droughts over the last few years, and people are moving from the countryside to the cities, and then they're moving into these sort of bidonvilles, these circular sort of slums around these cities, and they get partly educated. Part education is often worse than no education, and they become fodder for these educated religious extremists. Mm-hmm. That's what I was talking about. These are members of the educated middle class, professional class, because they've got nowhere to go and nothing to do, and they live in these miserable conditions. But they're in urban settings, so they have the capacity to act collectively and to organize, and they're constantly putting pressures on the PJD because this is a swelling constituency. So, and if the PJD doesn't keep them, they're going to go to the more radical and thus far illegal Islamist movement. And so the leaders feel compelled, even the moderate ones, to sort of occasionally issue, well, you know, it's the Jews, whatever. Well, you know, we got to keep in line with these guys. We got to speak to them. We got to find a way to address them. So they're essentially trying to keep all these balls in the air. And they're constantly trying to play catch-up with the process of socioeconomic change, which is undermining their credibility. And unless we have on the ground programs to sort of resolve the socioeconomic structural conditions, all the moderate sort of political elites in the world will not have the capacity to sell their moderation.
Okay. We really have the last question, if you can please be very brief. And because
Thank you. I have a comment, not question. My name is Fawzi Etemadi, and I'm a member of federal government. I'm from Afghanistan. I'm Muslim. I was just concerned about the question which came out of gender equality, liberation of women, and also democracy. Gender equality and liberation created a lot of problem in Afghanistan and the culture. And to my understanding, if we respect the culture of that particular country, and while going for outreach program, we should go to the mind and heart of people, supporting them. Why Hezbollah is successful in that region, or other extremists, because they are doing a noble job providing shelters, food, building schools, building hospitals, building roads, but their aim is very evil. It's an act of evil. But how about the United States, the peace-loving society, would go there, help and support, and build the road, and get to the heart and mind of the people, and bring peace and stability to the region with respect of the culture of that country.
Thank you. That's a very important point. Gender equality for me includes providing little girls with education, the same opportunities for women to run businesses. And so they are not simply just like legal, strictly legal, institutional. Gender equality includes having more women participate in public life, more educated girls in the countryside, and more business support, the kind of programs that you're talking about. So thank you all, and we'll have a lunch break, and then we'll resume in the afternoon at 1:15.
And we'll meet before the 3 years runs out. I lost my...